Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic FX. You found us again on this 270th day of the year. There's only 95 days left. So just to keep it all in proportion and perspective, I'm your host for the next hour or so, Dale Graham, Brother Dale Graham. And I welcome all Masons to the program and to guests who may be curious about the principles and philosophies that that float this boat. It's been a special occasion here in North America to be host of the Pontiff, somebody that is a Jesuit. I'm the first Pope, I understand, that is a Jesuit. The intellectual aspect of Catholic, Roman Catholicism, I believe. You, with bringing a message of reflection and hope to leaders and followers alike. It's what need to speak with you today. The focus will be a bit more lunar, because there's things going on in our atmosphere that some of you will already be aware. And I'll speak to that in a little bit. But I want to, the focus of today's gathering here is the mystic notions of Freemasonry. It's hard to really narrow down and define the what it is part of our great order. It's an amazing coincidence in a way that has endured. Hundreds of years, 300 years in this form, and closer to 500 years or even longer as a philosophical base. What if, and you think about, we're all sitting around a nice warm evening, and we're looking up at the night sky, and it's we're in medieval time, and we're wondering, what if there our thoughts could exist. We were able to explore questions outside of the influences of church and state. What if? And by posing that question, the reality is it becomes true. You can always do that. No one, in effect, controls the mind. But think of a time when we didn't realize that, and we had to become conscious of it. Now, either we think that man was always aware at that level, and was being and had to was being repressed by the override the oneness, the singularity that was sought by church and state. But remember, it was different times. So I'll just give you a little bit of a context about that to think about those questions as we would ask them today. But think about them in the day, in the medieval time. The legacy that we have from the Renaissance, think that these periods in history changed our thinking. Was the belief in genius. It was something rarer than skill or talent, and it would transform. Of course, it would transform the arts. This is something that, you know, the popular, the rush to to market populist thinking. The basis for television has really taken us and dragged us away and made this kind of thinking a bit more secure, a bit more obscure. It's taken us from respect for the trained talent, that's the Renaissance, manipulating the experience that is out there for all to know, to an awe before the uniquely inspired self. Now we hold genius in awe. From admiration to awe, from the imitation of nature to the recreation of nature. From the artist filling a patron's orders to the patron awaiting an artist's creations. As Russell Howell claimed, talent is that which is in a man's power. Genius is that in which power a man is. In ancient Roman religion, the genius, the Latin for the begetter, okay, that was the ruling spirit that perpetuated a household or a family. It came to mean the guardian spirit of a guild or a place or an individual which a person might worship on his birthday. After Augustus, the genius of an emperor would be worshipped. The spirit of a woman or a goddess was known and worshipped as a Juno. The spirit of a woman. But in medieval Europe, we didn't put high value on originality. If it had been proved that Leonardo da Vinci had copied the items in his notebooks from other books, it would have only increased respect for his learning and would not have stirred charges of plagiarism. We would have thought that's wonderful, you know, he's referencing other material. No, individualism. Individualism, a novel expression to which a novel idea has given birth, didn't enter our English vocabulary until 1835, when Tocqueville used it to describe what he found in America. But genius suggests originality. Now think about what Tocqueville was talking about. Tocqueville was not talking about America as we know it today. The carnage and the tiring sense of superiority over the entire globe. That the experiment of capitalism now on the rocks. They were not talking about that, this reality. They were the product of social media. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a simpler, much more radical form of being. This was the alternative to what had happened before politically. And there was a freedom attached to that, which had appeal, still does. But perhaps think of it like the first time that you sat down and enjoyed a lobster, or the first time you heard an opera, or the first time you heard that country song that just moved you to tears. But this is a genius suggesting originality after that. Deeper roots, like Michelangelo, a unique, unpredictable, a creator who casts a spell over the arts, you know, of modern times. Think of it when we use that kind of language. This is getting into the language of masonry. So Chaugur, Dante, and Giotto were admired for their awesome immortality of their works. Yet the word divine was rarely applied to living artists or poets before the 16th century. So Alberti, in his work in painting in 1436, already saw in the artist a divine power. Leonardo declared the painter's work nobler than that of nature, and his painter was a second god. Somebody you may not have heard of. The Portuguese painter Francesco de Holanda observed in Rome in 1538 that in Italy, one does not care for the renown of great princes. It's a painter only that they call divine. So during the Middle Ages, the artist had been a man of trained skills and disciplined life. The earliest painters, the guilds of the late 13th century, oversaw the lives and works of members and their religious activities, their contracts of apprenticeship, and their relation to patrons. in Florence after 1293. No one had civil rights who was not a member of his proper guild. Now think about the influence, the intellect here. And nobody was considered had civil rights who lived in defiance of the guild. That was very unusual. But when Bernaleschi refused to pay his dues to the guild of building a work, the incredible sculptor, he was imprisoned for 11 days. He was the architect of the cathedral. They threw him in jail. He said, I'm not paying that. You know, I'm there, blah, blah, blah. And this was a guild of building workers, like laborers. He said, look at me. I'm above all of that. They threw him in prison. And then they had the authorities secured his release. The authorities, the higher authority, went and said, let's get him out of there. We've got to finish the cathedral. We've got to get him back there to work. Guilds were losing their monopolies, but not until 1571 did a decree exempt members of the Florentine Academy from guild membership. There was an elite. Yeah? The guild still occurred, but the elite didn't have to be. The Protestant Reformation, wary of images and churches, deprived painters and sculptors of their best traditional patron. Who was the best traditional patron? The church. Yeah. But about the same time, merchant bankers, like the Medici, created a more varied demand, offering artists a new chance to be original. Yeah. So we saw the morphing of influence. So the roles of patron and of artist were being strangely reversed. From telling the artist what you wanted produced, the artist began to be the innovator, the genius. When we see the spirit in her dealings with Leonardo da Vinci, we know more about the Marchioness Isabella d'Este de Mantua. She was collecting works by the best painters of her time and wanted an allegorical picture to be delivered by the following June. And she gave every detail. And she wrote to the Carmelite Vicar General of Florence, your reverence might find out if he could undertake to paint a picture for our studio. If he consents, we would leave the subject and time to him, but if he declines, you might at least induce him to paint a little picture of the Madonna, as sweet and holy as his whole nature. Giovanni Bellini in 1506 in France let her specify the size of the painting, but insisted that all else be left to his imagination. Now, I didn't know this was the period of Albrecht Dürer of Nuremberg. Remember, the watercolorist, the incredible the draftsman, who happened to be in Venice. He was impressed by the independence of Italian art. Here I am, a gentleman, he said, and at home a mere parasite. So this, I think, there's more. Certainly, the stories that we hear are incredibly important. One of the more profound that influenced my life was the story of the entered apprentice and the pillar, the apprentice's pillar that we find in Roslyn Chapel. The basic part of it is that the master went away and came back, and the apprentice had finished the second pillar, only had put on such embellishments and shown in his work in stone such talent that the master realized it was beyond his own ability. And in a murderous, egocentric rage, he murdered his apprentice. In a way, I think the metaphor is rather revealing. We all work for a master. And at some point, we are all, part of us is murdered by ego. Now, that form of that murder, the motive for that murder varies. and what gets inside our skin is that it is always about our true talent, what we are. This is what Freemasonry helps us to do. It is as much based on the hard fact reality. What do we do? It's like, what does Google do for the world? Well, what does Volkswagen now do to clean up the, diabolically clever? They're too clever by far with their software that shut off emissions control after any emissions assessment. Now, like all pirates, they're caught. This is an example of something that's gone on in the marketplace from the very earliest times. But Freemasonry is a freedom to be able to examine that. Take that, those events, put them in the palm of your hand, stretch out your arm in front of you and your mates, and examine and discuss. Look at what were they thinking? What was going, inevitably, men of our maturity realize you'll be caught because it's not something of merit that you're creating. It's something of malicious. You'll be caught, fool that they are. Rich fool. Here, the show today, Freemasonry, the Mystic. But I want to talk to you, have a little bit of fun with this. Well, I want to set I want to set it up a little bit by from our friend Ralph Waldo Emerson. Here's some reading that I think this is some of his work on self-reliance that we took in last week, a little piece of it. So I'm just going to let you listen to a little taste of this again. Remember, this is a dish best served like an hors d'oeuvre. It's not an entree yet.
Familiar as the voice of the mind is to each, the highest merit we ascribe to Moses, Plato, and Milton is that they set at naught books and traditions and spoke not what men, but what they thought. A man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within more than the luster of the firmament of bards and sages. Yet he dismisses without notice his thought because it is his. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. Great works of art have no more affecting lesson for us than this. They teach us to abide by our spontaneous impression with good-humored inflexibility the most when the whole cry of voices is on the other side. Else tomorrow, a stranger will say with masterly good sense precisely what we have thought and felt all the time, and we shall be forced to take with shame our own opinion from another. There is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better or worse as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil, bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till. The power which resides in him is new in nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried. Not for nothing, one face, one character, one fact makes much impression on him, and another none. This sculpture in the memory is not without pre-established harmony. The eye was placed where one ray should fall, that it might testify of that particular ray. We but half express ourselves, and are ashamed of that divine idea which each of us represents. It may be safely trusted as proportionate and of good issues, so it be faithfully imparted. But God will not have his work made manifest by cowards. A man is relieved and gay when he has put his heart into his work and done his best. But what he has said or done otherwise shall give him no peace. It is a deliverance which does not deliver. In the attempt, his genius deserts him. No muse befriends, no invention, no hope. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string.
Ah, trust thyself. Trust your judgment. The maturity, when we become emotionally mature, that's what happens. Are we, so in a way, as we hold the world and all existence in the palm of our hand, we can examine things a little differently. What does this do to you? Well, I can't really say that, speak to you about that. That's a very intimate and personal matter. What the teachings have done for me so far is to realize that I am not living for legacy. I'm not living to be remembered for great acts or the temporary deeds. Temporary because in the grand scheme of things, 1,000 years I'm not likely to be remembered. But I began to examine this clamor to be remembered. You know, Alexander or Henry IV or, you know, different people in some level of power with that self-declared need to think that they can orchestrate their value for the world. People that we remember are people of talent, not people that are striving to be remembered. That's childish. That's, look at me. I need your attention in order to feel whole. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. What Emerson reminds us, the aesthetic, I just love this aesthetic, don't you? The aesthetic of Emerson is to understand your nature, not to be leaking all this language out of your mouth because you're clamoring to overcome your own anxieties and trying to be accepted. Are you such a medieval thinker that it's the repetition? Certainly the Americas have taken us on that path in a large way. Don't be giving me too much stick just yet. The effort has been to clone the towns and cities in existence to achieve a uniformity. The great nation of individuals striving to be as uniform as the individuals of the senior high school classes. Everybody dressing so uniquely and expressing themselves, but in doing it, looking as if they are the clones. The malls that have the same shops everywhere rob us of the character of the people that live in these particular areas. So we look longingly across the ocean, 3,000 miles of challenging seas, to a world that has depth only because they were populated in large numbers earlier and through a time when we began to write down our history. Over here, where I am in North America, we're young. We develop with that hand outstretched in front of us to examine the good, the bad, and the indifferent. What was the effects of the intense class stratification that we talk about as imperialism? It was relentless. You and I can examine this, but as we turn that object around, imperialism around, we can say, well, there was some good to it. But to be able to do that, we have to accept that we're pretty diabolical in the first instance. That the domination, you think about it by any standard, bringing the sale of heroin into the Chinese ports in order to make money, in order to demonstrate the naval superiority, that is a stain on the conscience of humanity just as much as Hoover, as Truman, making this meager decision to drop a bomb on Japanese children and old people. And we can examine, are we of that medieval link that we gain merit by quoting other people, that we favor that you raise in esteem when you can have many, many references? In other words, you're sort of that mixture of different ideas from other people from the past. There's not much genius, but the likes of somebody like me, I don't have much in the way of ascribing to a sense of genius. I barely do well to get by. But methodically, I need to be able to, the teachings are to come to terms with that nature. Freemasonry, the mystic, freed from religious intolerance, neither dilettante nor subservient. We travel around the globe, making a life on the next shore, exchanging ideas from somewhere else with those new to us, seeming enlightened, though few would make such a claim. True Masons? No, we're always in that process of learning. Mouthing philosophies which remain aspirational. We are Freemasonry, you and I. Our order preserves the ancient charges while desiring to give each entered apprentice the opportunity to learn in an artist's studio, a scholar's library, an alchemical laboratory. We will be amazed by the success of that endeavor that has withstood the test of time, the test of history. It is all with us, as it has been for generations. Freemasonry does not change as history changes, but it is always Freemasonry. It is always history. Means something. I need to, we'll come back with more on this notion of the mystic aspect of Freemasonry. Here's a little tune that I think, a very old tune. This is performed by Celtic Woman, contemporary. And this was recorded at Slane Castle. It's the middle name of a good friend of mine. Slane Castle happens, for those who are not familiar, is in Ireland. And there's some interesting history about how the Scots were living in Ireland and coming over here. Yeah. a woman by the name of Haley Ostenza. She's the newest member of that singing group. We like to think that we like to hear stories about people that have overcome adversity. I want to tell you about the life of a person that you may know in one way, but not in another. The coincidence of how we achieve. The coincidence, the toss of a coin that we can turn around and make seem as if it was a deliberate plan. There's something divine, there's something mystical going on in the world around us. Here's a little example. Maybe it'll make you think of the power of the divine. Maybe not. This is about someone you know, in a way. Michelangelo. He's born on the 6th of March, 1475. And his father was Ludovico Buonavarti. And he was the mayor of a village in Caprese, near Arezzo, in Italy. And from a family that boasted that it had descended from the Counts of Canossa. And this was the child would be great because the planets Mercury with Venus in Secunda being received into the house of Jupiter. So at the time of his birth, so the cosmos were aligned, and this indicated that the birth should be of a noble and high genius, able to succeed in every undertaking, but principally those of the arts that delight the senses. The arts that don't, painting, sculpture, and architecture. Brilliant. The family moved to Florence, and when Michelangelo's mother died when he was only 6 years old. And he liked to say that his nurse was the daughter of a stone carver and wife of a stone carver. And he said, if my brains are any good at all, he told his student Vasari later on, it was because I was born in the pure air of your Arezzo countryside, just as with my mother's milk, I sucked in the hammer and chisels I use for my statues. He said, this is a profound influence. Buonarroti placed his other four sons with the wool and silk guilds, but he couldn't afford to send Michelangelo to a grammar school. But he could only afford to send him to a grammar school. And that's where the boy stole time from his studies. He was obsessed with drawing. And his fathers and older brothers tried to cure that obsession by beating him occasionally. But finally, abandoning hope of forcing the boy to give up drawing for some more elevated pursuit, Ludovico apprenticed him at the age of 14 to the painter Domenico Ghirlandaio. He was precocious. He was curious. He made copies of works by masters that were indistinguishable, it is said, from the originals. He's 14. And then he aged them with smoke. And then he exchanged them with the originals. He wanted the originals to study. After a year, he left the painter's workshop for a curious art school that Lorenzo the Magnificent. This is Lorenzo Medici, remember? And he accumulated great art, and he paid artists from around the world to come and study together to create that atmosphere, that synergy. This is Lorenzo. The study of the Medici family is just a tasty treat. But Lorenzo had collected all kinds of antique sculpture, and he employed a pupil of Donatello as a teacher. Can you imagine how now he hoped to gather young talent like Michelangelo to establish a new school of painters and sculptors? Even as a boy, though, Michelangelo had sculpted masterly reliefs. You know a relief? his Madonna of the Stairs and the Battle of the Centaurs, two of the pieces that we renown, that amaze. And he discovered Michelangelo's rare talent in the prime art. The prime art is what is also called sculpture. And Lorenzo added the boy to his household so he could live there with the artists and writers and painters and sculptors. And his father is referred to as a Philistine. Ah, how common is this, eh? Lodovico Buonarroti still found it hard to see the difference between a stonemason and a sculptor. Yeah, stone is stone, you know, the tools are, and thought neither occupation suitable for a scion of the Counts of Canossa. You know, this is beneath. But another Medici apprentice, the envious Torridiano, left his mark on the face of Michelangelo. They were ill-tempered with one another. And this, for this reason, because of his problem with his temper, Torrigiano was eventually banished from Florence. They kicked him out after his fist broke Michelangelo's nose. That's it, get out, you know, you've had enough. When Lorenzo de' Medici died in 1492, the boy returned to live with his Philistine father. Oh, but except he never ceased to be known as a Medici partisan in Florence. Turbulent politics, yeah? While living with his father from 1492 to 1494, he often heard of the eloquent Savonarola preach at the Cathedral of Florence. And this Savonarola was very passionate and very persuasive, and he was declared the enemy of the arts. He declared that the enemy of the arts that made Florence great, that was him, and he mistrusted the ancient classics. The only good thing that we owe to Plato and Aristotle, Savonarola preached, is that they brought forward many arguments which we can use against the heretics. Yet they and other philosophers are now in hell. This is the big influence, eh? An old woman knows more about faith than Plato, Savonarola, who drove the Medici from Florence in 1494 and established a democratic dictatorship for himself. Oh, of course. In the Piazza della Signoria in 1497, he ignited his famous bonfire of the vanities, feeding it with carnival costumes and masks and wigs and cosmetics and mirrors and playing cards and musical instruments and every kind of work of art, with volumes of corrupt Latin and Italian poets, including Boccaccio. When the Medici fled Florence, so did Michelangelo, first to Bologna and then in 1496 to Rome, as the widest field for a man to show his genius in. There he landed in Rome. And he took some commissions, a Bacchus for a banker, and for a cardinal, the Pietà. A cardinal to commission that, which was the first important work on the Christian themes that would consume his life and would become one of St. Peter's featured attractions. But meanwhile, in Florence, Savonarola, having exhausted the power of his eloquence, was tortured, hanged, and burned. It's like, are you crazy? You're ruining the culture. Look at this. And yeah, he made himself a democratic dictator. And those are people that just manipulate the rules to get what they want. When Michelangelo returned to Florence in 1501, the Republic had commissioned him. He was 26 years old. They commissioned him to do the David. Ah. Then, and that became the symbol of the city in 1504, to do a fresco at the Palazzo Vecchio opposite Leonardo's. But, like Leonardo's battle piece, was never finished and didn't survive. Now, there's more. Of course there's more. Are you kidding me? There's more. But enough, eh? You have the sense? You have the sense? A bit. Was it by design? that we refer to this as genius, this talent? Could it have been, you know, just a matter of luck that his Philistine father, had more influence over him? No difference between a sculptor and a stonemason. You know, and we're not talking about this as a member of the ancient peoples of southern Palestine. We're not talking about 12th and 11th century BC stuff. No. It's defined as people who believe that most of our greatness is transient. These are people whose behavior, it describes the behavior of ignorant, ill-behaved peoples that lack culture and this artistic appreciation. Philistine, you might as well know. These are words that came back down to us. The term was grasped and defined by Matthew Arnold. The anti-intellectualism. If it's based on thought, it must be wrong. So, of course, human beings walked the surface of the earth with dinosaurs, Philistines, that art galleries are a waste of time, that symphonies, that the work of Beethoven, the work of Bach, the work of Haydn, the work of Mozart, and the work of Beethoven are meaningless. Why would anybody bother? That influence could have prevailed, yeah? And we saw it. Savonarola actually convinced people, you know, let's burn all the books, let's kill the idea of culture. Let's kill the meaning. If we burn the books, if we burn the paintings, if we burn the poetry, then we kill the idea. Then we can live cleansed. Oh, if only that were true. The Puritans and the Quakers would have achieved their goals a lot greater extent in the past. We're just going to put out here a little tune by a fellow that has taken on a bit of a notoriety all on his own. First as a commercial artist in the 60s, and then as he evolved his around the life of a devoted Muslim, then came back to his art form. This you'll remember. This is from 1976. You'll probably have tapped your toe to it different times. Thank you. Mine is the sunlight, mine is the morning, born of the one light, Eden's all play. Praise with elation, praise every morning, God's recreation of the new day. Gentle touch, a gentle touch on the world. The work of Cat Stevens. Don't think that you weren't drawn to masonry for a reason. Perhaps you haven't examined the notion of destiny or its effect on you. Maybe this is an interesting time to do it. Tonight, we're going to be experiencing what's referred to as a blood moon. Very rare. And we're going to see a total eclipse. The moon falls into the Earth's shadows, yeah? We see this more frequently than solar eclipses because of the ellipse. The elliptical notion, you know, movement of the moon, it's not just a perfect little circle around us. You already know that. But it comes closer to the Earth, and it looks about 14% bigger, larger than normal. And because we're looking at it through, as it comes through the edge of the Earth's atmosphere, it pulls out all of the blue light rays and leaves us with this red. You might have been out like me looking at it last night and wondered, is it just sort of pink the night before? Well, no, it's because it's not lined up to have this lens, the prism, I guess, either way I look at it, of the Earth's atmosphere. So we're going to see that tonight, 27th. The total eclipse coincides with the full moon nearest the fall equinox. And that, of course, is what we call the harvest moon. And what's more, the moon is at its closest approach to Earth for the entire year. So that's what we call a super moon or perigee moon, so old sailors out there. That's why it's being spoken of, coined as a super harvest blood moon all at once. And it only happened 5 times since 1900. So according to NASA, the last time we saw this celestial triple combination was 1982. And it won't be repeated again until 2033. 2033, this is 2015. So that's, 18 years from now. I'm not too sure I'm going to be wheeling out in the backyard here in 18 years from now to see it. So I'll take a look. I hope you do it. I hope the clouds cooperate, the gods cooperate. This weekend's blood moon will be the last in a series of 4 lunar eclipses that have happened over the past 2 years. And that pattern won't come around again for another 20 years. I'm not sure I'll be around then, but maybe I will. Gives me a connection. Thousands of years, these kind of things have made us stand in awe and a bit afraid. What is going on? That's before we had science to explain this. So tonight, if you're thinking about it, the idea of destiny, maybe you can take advantage of the celestial significance. To maybe you can think of yourself as part of that entire larger process that depends on your imagination. Imagination is necessary for us to answer all of the questions. You determine the questions, but without it, there's certain questions that cannot be answered. Is your destiny something that is to happen or has happened to a particular person or thing or a lot, the predetermined, inevitable course of events? The power of agency or an agency that determines the course of events, is that within our vocabulary? Almost been pushed out. Do you believe in, but on a personal, intimate level, do you believe in destiny? Or is destiny then, as Pythagoras began to teach, as Plato began to teach, is this a process of mathematics, the genius, the clarity and purity of understanding the equations and the influences, the algorithms that happen around us? We can toy with the world as if it all is a binary process. So are you a one or a zero? A little bit on the genius of Freemasonry. This was from a book given to me by a very, very dear friend, Wilf. It's something that I keep very close to me on my desk and in my closest stack of books over there in the bookshelf. And it opens the frontispiece. A few rudimentary lessons in architecture, a few universally admitted maxims of morality, a few unimportant traditions whose real meaning is unknown or misunderstood, will no longer satisfy the earnest inquiry about Masonic truths. That was by the late Albert Pike, taken from his work Morals and Dogma. That's a feast. I picked this, on the frontispiece of Mystic Masonry, or the Symbols of Freemasonry and the Greater Mysteries. I feel more comfortable talking about this in 2015 because my notion of secrecy and privacy have been altered. Looking over my shoulder is the state. Looking at every aspect, and I feel in some ways more secure for that, but come on now. Don't expect me to think that I live with the same sense of security and privacy that my grandfather did, Brother Cyril Toombs. Nope, things have changed, and I've been part of allowing that change to occur. It hasn't been power that's claimed that. It's been me. The traditions and glyphs and ritual of Freemasonry cluster around the building of the temple, the legend of the widowed son, Hiram Abiff, who lost his life in the defense of his integrity, and the search of the lost word of the master. As the candidate progresses, degree after degree, he is furnished with the working tools suited to his degree of knowledge and proficiency, and given instruction as to their use. The lesser and greater lights are revealed and explained, and through all, each outer form or material thing is shown to be a symbol of a deeper mystery, a concealed potency. Doesn't that paragraph really reveal all of our secrets? You'd have to go through the experience to plug that one into your brain. I'm sorry, but I don't mean to be smug about it, but for all people who aren't Masons out there, it is less, it's very, very superficial. I realize and apologize for that. But it can't I don't know how to describe experience. I don't have words. Artists do, painters, poets do, sculptors do, but I'm not that. I'm not of that link. You'll have to go out and explore, and with these notions in mind. And why would you? Why would you? For some malicious reason? Rather unflattering. The what we are seeing is, in brief, the language of philosophy and symbolism are the exoteric and the esoteric garb of truth. The method itself, outside of all details or applications, has a deeper scientific significance than most persons were aware of. This method of instruction is not fanciful or arbitrary, but conforms with the process of eternal nature in building an atom or a world, a daisy or a man. Cosmos has evolved from chaos, and yet chaos remains the eternal potency of what Plato called the world of divine ideas. This will be more fully explained later in this work, in this reading, so we'll get into that, I promise you. For the present, it's enough to say that from primitive space, primordial ether, or what modern science might call the matrix, or origin of the nebulous mass, the Earth and all that it contains has evolved. Don't tell me the boys didn't have a grasp of what's happening around us currently. Don't tell me that. The matrix. You come back and join me, I hope. The hard part about this program is that you and I can't argue. We can't discuss, we can't debate, we can't reconsider and reflect. And I put out these questions to you knowing that, you know, that a lot of people share similar worldviews. And so I'm putting words to begin to describe ideas. And as soon as we can describe them, we can put them in the palm of our hand, hold them out there for examination. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us on Masonic Effects. I look forward to pressing the flesh with each one of you, and to our visitors, thank you very much for taking the time to be curious about Freemasonry. It is influences, and it is examination. It's like the large classroom of the universe. It's great. Check this out. See you soon. This is Tom Jones.
Stand on that chair. Ooh, baby, that's right.